Thank you, Alan. Alan is an Alan, of course, and I'm an Alan. And Alan has only one L. But I'd feel no sense of disparaging him because of this, because I have two L's. And, of course, his other name is Lloyd, and that gives him three L's. So that's, I'm just going to... This will be a rambling thing, really. I'm a bit of a mess. I make the most intricate notes and think deeply and hard about what to do, but I'm trying very hard to make a souffle, or I'm trying very hard to walk a tightrope, but to work it out in advance, which you can't do. If I wrote it all out, it would be dead. But if I do it spontaneously, which to some extent I will, with these tiny little notes, I fall off, which is not quite what you wanted either. For example, I had not intended to do this, but I shall begin by... Because I requested a cup of coffee, and I was given a cup of coffee, and it reminded me of a thing that I do with school children sometimes. I get invited to go to a school, and I sit up like this, and they put the entire... Schools, in the old days, used to take the advantage of putting everybody, every child in the school, in the hall, and then the staff would disappear to the staff room and have a cup of tea. There would be this cup of coffee, and I would say to the children, how pleased I was to see them. You must pretend now that you're 350 or 400 children. How nice it is to be in your school, and I'm really pleased. And your teacher, Mrs. Jones, who was a great, great friend of mine, she said, Alan, would you like to come to my school, and would you like to have a cup of coffee? The coffee we make in our school is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And I said, well, I think, thank you, Mary, boldly using her Christian name. Thank you, Mary. And so I've come, and she said, but then she said, Alan, she said, would you mind very much if you drank your cup of coffee in the hall? Well, I thought this was a bit odd, you know, but she was such a good friend of mine. I said, well, yes, Mary, I will do that. And she said, it is very nice coffee. She said, would you mind if all the children of the school came into the hall and sat and watched you while you drink your coffee? Well, this was ridiculous. Of course, it was so silly. And so I said, well, but aren't you such a good, wonderful friend? I never met this woman, but she's a wonderful friend of mine. And I said, all right. And so I said, I will do that. And I lean back like this and I go... And then the game is, how long can I hold it before the children begin to realize there's nothing else is going to happen? So, yes, this is the Ledbury Poetry Festival. I don't think I've ever technically been to a poetry festival before. I've been to other sorts of literary events, usually in my capacity as a maker, a writer, of children's books. But this is an adult thing, and... I've laboured long and hard over how to walk this tightrope so that it doesn't look as though I haven't got on it for the first moment. And I thought, well, it's a poetry festival. Poems. That's what they want. They want poems. Here's a poem. This poem is called The Actor's Mother. I was a school teacher on and off for about 10 years. And I loved it. For 10 years. And one of my great pleasures was putting on plays with my class for the rest of the school and for the parents. It was a brilliant junior school, so I had a class usually of 10 and 11 years, third and fourth year juniors, and we would make a play, we would build the set, we would create the story and act it out, and the parents would come of an evening and see it, with other classes doing their plays as well. And I always thought that's what we were doing. I thought, well, yes, here we are. Here's a teacher, here's his kids, and we are putting on a play, and the parents are coming to see the play. They weren't coming to see the play at all. The actor's mother. The actor's mother. No charming, chatty prince for him, lines by the yard. He mostly stands there with a spear. My son, the guard. He never plays the captain's part. Always the crew. Aye, aye, he cries occasionally. His lines are few. He doesn't get the better roles, takes after me. Sometimes he never speaks at all. My son, the tree. The only time he got some lines, just half a page, he had to shout them through a door, invisibly, off stage. Still, curtains fall eventually, and homeward in the car, his dad and I can then admire our son, the star. And it took me a long while to... In fact, it wasn't until I was a parent myself that I appreciated... That's why the parents came. If this was a school play now and your kid was on the stage, you would be relatively indifferent to the structural cunning of the play or the way in which the setting. What was your little boy or your little girl up to? And that's that. So that's that. Oh yes. No. This I'm going to pretend I don't know what this is. I can't. I have a brief which is to sort of talk to you as adults about making things for children and so on. And I can't, as you can tell really, I don't really know how to do it. Because my instinct is to do what I'm doing now, which is... This is a panda. Now, if there's time and it works out, I will explain the significance of this panda. If those of you near the front can see that he's got a rather sour expression. He's not an emollient panda. He's a rather fierce panda. And if I can... get to the end before it's time for us to leave, I'll tell you. But you keep an eye on him because he's a significant panda. What did I say? I had another word for him, significant panda. Anyway. This pocket thing works quite well because when I forget where I am, I know as long as I remember which pocket, I'm all right. Oh yes, this is me, really. There are one or two little snapshots of me. If I remember, there's one of me as a school teacher later on. But this is me. This is a snapshot of me more or less now, really. You can tell by looking at me, I'm gradually falling apart. The bits are falling off and the things don't work very well and all the stuff that we all know about, many of us anyway. And the slow man. The phone rings, but no. Oh, sorry. I must read this with less vigour. The slow man. The phone rings, but never long enough for the slow man. This is a tragic poem. Will you please? By the time the set's switched on, his favourite program's over. His tea grows cold from cup to lip. His soup evaporates. He laughs eventually at jokes long since gone out of fashion. Sell-by dates and limited special offers defeat him. He comes home with yesterday's paper and reads it tomorrow. There's a bit more to me than that, but that's actually, if one took a snapshot of any person in this room now, you could get 10 different accounts of us, can't you? And so one account of me is I'm terribly slow and elderly and falling apart, but luckily there's a bit more. Oh, yes, sorry, the third pocket. This is a good one. On occasions like this, here am I now sitting up on a platform, and you're sitting on, it's like the Lord of the Manor, and I've invited you into this wonderful hall to tell you a few important things. And it can get to you, can't it? Many of you, people in this room, must have been where I am now, and the situation is reversed. It's flattering, and it's tempting, and it's seductive, and it's... it's not altogether a good thing. My scheme on occasions like this is to arrive wherever I'm supposed to be earlier than I'm supposed to be there, and to go somewhere and to find a quiet corner and buy a copy of the Guardian newspaper and get a glass of wine and sit in the corner and just drink and read and forget that I'm going to see you all tonight. That sounds a bit ill-mannered, but it's how it works. This is today's Guardian, which I'm fresh from the. But anyway, this is much earlier. This is This is 15 or 20 years ago, Guardian. A wonderful letter to the Guardian by a man called Len Clay, who lived in Fiskerton, Newark. And I find it, this letter, I can't not use it on occasions like this, because it's comic and it's funny, and it does seriously address the thing of self-importance, of, you know, I'm up here and you're down there and all that rubbish. From Len Clay. Sir, the Hubble telescope reveals 1,500 galaxies, each containing up to 100 billion stars, all streaming away from Earth at 19,000 miles per second, 68,400,000 miles an hour. All I can say is, thank goodness they are not heading this way. Ludicrous. We're laughing at it, aren't we? What about Jesus? We're all sitting around a vast kind of hot oven of the sun, which is like a great cooker that can explode. Anyway, I read that, and I do the correspondence column, as many of you I know are familiar with, in The Guardian, is charming, really. The collective bunch of readers of the paper get bees in their bonnet, and they've had a thing lately about blackbirds singing in gardens. And these blackbirds keep on imitating popular, well-known tunes, and so on. But this is the best one I've come upon. Re-Blackbirds, letter 7th July. We had one that used to do Paul McCartney's Blackbird Singing in the Dead of Night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Wonder which one of them thought of it first. I will finish on time, but you wouldn't think it, because I'm halfway down these tiny little postcards. I'm only on... Yes. I have to keep bringing myself back to... Yes. I think the reason I was invited to come here, because I've been writing material for children on and off for many years, was I wrote a book a couple of years ago that ostensibly was for adults. It had verse and prose in it, and it was called The Bucket. And it begins with a little poem which I wrote quite a few years earlier than the book itself, called Having a Baby. And Having a Baby is about... the way in which my mother collected me from the orphanage, because I was adopted in 1938. So I'll read you that, I think. I came from Battersea in 1938, delivered by a steam train, 40 minutes late. Not the dog's home, though. My mother went to fetch me by tram, then train, with Dad, as usual, working. Hopes's window frames. Or was it Danks's boilers? My mother had a shopping bag, booties, bottle, shawl, and knitting for the journey. Not much else at all. A purse, I suppose, hat, glasses and such. She struggled across London, got lost near Waterloo, and came at last to the orphanage at 2:55. Early, even so, for a 2 o'clock appointment. They sat her in the corridor, left her there till 3, then gave her a couple of documents, a form to sign, and me. She couldn't see to write. Me glasses needed wipers. I remember my mother saying that. Me glasses needed wipers, she said. Back then to Paddington, weather wet and mild. Brand new mother. Second-hand child. Good condition, though. One previous owner. And mother clutched her secret on her lap from all the other passengers all the way back. Dad, still in his overalls, was on the platform. He squeezed us in a cuddle, gave me a clumsy kiss. He smelled of wood shavings and oil. Mum specially remembered this. And me, asleep apparently. I'd had a busy day. My mother told me of course, adoption, as you can imagine, in those times in the 1940s, illegitimacy, which of course is what I was a shameful business. So my mother and my father pretended that I wasn't adopted at all, that I was their child. And then when that cat was out of the bag, they tried to pretend that my parents had been killed in an aeroplane crash. You know, some ludicrous one. And I noticed when I wrote this, most of the verse I write is verse, not poetry, by the way. I think I hesitated to come to a poetry festival. I think there is a distinction between poetry and verse, poetry being the greater, more mysterious, more powerful thing. But good verse is better than rubbish poetry, of course. But It's to do with authenticity and persuading someone that it's true. So there's a verse here that says, and mother clutched her secret on her lap from all the other passengers all the way back. And I thought to myself, well, lap doesn't rhyme with back. And normally that would annoy me. But I thought, well, they might think I'm telling the truth if I'm prepared to bend the rhyme, if I'm going to abandon the rhyme in order to say what actually happened. So you see, I'm getting close now to the beginning of this talk. This having a baby comes from a book called The Bucket, and The Bucket is a book of little pieces in prose and verse about my childhood in the 1940s. And it started out, I try and write some verse that talks about childhood more for the adult than the child. And I did this for a little while, but with an immensely simple, the most simple four-line stanza that you can imagine, with the second and the fourth line rhyme, that's it. And then after a while I found that I couldn't always say what I wanted to say in that form, because the rhymes wouldn't fall out. And so I found myself writing prose by default, as it were. But it made a much better book, because the prose, if you could have written a book like this, all in that same rather mundane, plain little stanza, it would have been monotonous. So the prose broke it up. So what had been forced on me because I couldn't manage certain things, technically, was a good thing, I think. And that's, I'll read one or two of them from this book. And this one is called The Mangle. There's enough grey hairs in this room. You know what a mangle was. In the steamy wash house, my mother's face is pink as she wrestles with Dad's overalls in the soap-suddy sink. The overalls don't like it. I see them fighting back. Mum wrings their arms and legs out. The water turns quite black. My mother's arms are mighty. Her shoulders rise and fall. The scrubbing brush is in her hand, and green soap conquers all. The mangle's my opponent. It lifts me off my feet. It takes the total weight of me to mangle up a sheet. Two heavy wooden rollers, cogs like a giant clock, a handle for the turning, sheet, shirt or sock, go squelching in on one side, come flattened out the other. I fling that handle high and wide and help my boiling mother. With puny muscles all geared up, my strength is that of 10. We feed the overalls to their doom and feed them in again. The battle's almost over. The vanquished washing lies in a woven wooden basket. The mangle creaks and sighs. A smell of soot from the boiler, sweat on my youthful nose, steam on mother's glasses, a pile of flattened clothes. The washhouse stands deserted, as silent as the grave. The mangle, damp and dripping, a monster in a cave. While elsewhere in the windy yard, pegged out and looking fine, Dad's resurrected overalls are dancing on the line. And it was from this book that I've got the title that undoubtedly magnetised all of you to come here this evening, which is Trapdoors in the Grass. I didn't really need a title, did I? All the other poets have just put their name on them. They just said, come and hear Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith. But from the tradition that I come from, which is children's stuff, you give them a title, which is what you're going to talk about, and then you say what it's going to be about. And usually they want this stuff much earlier. So they said, well, can you give us a title? And I said, well, Trapdoors in the Grass. I thought that was a nice title. What are you going to talk about? Well, it seems that apparently what found its way into the brochure was, I propose to explore the notion of children's books, children's poems for adults. I mean, explore the notion of children's poems. So I will do that, of course. Perhaps I'll just... Because I realise you're getting rather more prose than you must have thought you were paying for. But Trapdoors in the Grass. This entire thing that I'm doing now is like a souffle or walking on a tightrope. Really, I make lots of notes and I think about it deeply and earnestly, endlessly. But if it isn't playful. If I'm not making it up now as I am and forget, and I'm nervous that I can't remember what the hell I'm going to say next, it has no life in it. So I spontaneously picked the title, Trapdoors in the Grass, because I like the title. One of the pieces in this book is called Trapdoors in the Grass, and I think I'll read it. It's only about a couple of pages, quite little pages. Without explanation, I think it says something about what I'm up to, really, which is about... It's just about remembering mysterious little fragments. I used to go and get my hair cut in Bath, where I live, at a traditional barber's, and there was an old man who was the father and his sons, and they were the barber's sons. My head in a towel, my wet hair being dried. The barber is as old as me or thereabouts. He dries my hair the way my mother did, but not so roughly. My mother was much rougher. He even dries inside my ears as she did. When I was little, the towel enveloped me. Tin bath in front of the fire, pajamas warming on the oven door, soap in a cup. My mother was a cleaner of offices and other people's houses and me. She did a thorough job beating back the tide of dirt that ever sought to claim her precious son, screwing one corner of the skinny towel into my ears like a bradawl. My mother's cleaning jobs opened up new worlds for us, posher houses, gardens, garages. The daughters of one family she cleaned for, Cecilia her name was. Cecilia, such a flowing, such a romantic name, Cecilia. And her brother was my age and size. Now and then I'd inherit one of his unwanted but still wearable shirts, thin, pretty stripes, or a jumper of the softest wool. Otherwise, my jumpers were homemade, hand-knitted by my mum and Auntie Mabel. My hands manacled, yes, handcuffed by the skeins of Auntie Mabel's wool. Another posh person was Mr. Griffin, the insurance man, collar and tie, waistcoat, briefcase, calling once a week to collect his money, accumulating his heavy load of shillings, sixpences and pennies. The smoke from his pipe often arrived before he did. He had a bald head with a semicircular fringe of hair, like my present barber, and for that matter his two barber sons, here now at their respective chairs, left and left again of their father. A bald trio of barbers, my head in a towel. The memorable aroma of Mr. Griffin's pipe. When my mother was old and I was middle-aged, I would visit her in her council bungalow high up on the Round's Green Hills. She would stand behind me, like the barber now, as I sat in a chair, and tap lightly with her knuckles on the top of my head, sounding me out like a coconut or a boiled egg. "Where's it all come from, then?" she'd ask, meaning all those children's books I was writing. Good, bad, or indifferent they may have been, but there were a lot of them. It was a puzzle to her how I had turned out. And she'd pretend to open me up, lift my lid, and look inside. There's a flash of light caught on a windscreen in the street outside, bouncing about in the barber's mirror, fractured in its beveled edges, rainbowed. The shop window lettering reversed and reversed again in the mirror, out of sense, and back into it. And I recall the trapdoors in the grass, in the park, cut with Billy Harrell's penknife, three sides and the fourth for a hinge. Lift the lid and look inside. A little cavity, treasures hidden, toy soldier, marble, penny, and returned to later, rediscovered. I bet we lost a few things, though, forgot their whereabouts. There again, the park is still there, with its descendant grass. I could go back and look. It is a curious thing to think that there's a park. I've gotten over 50 years what's happened to the level of the grass. But in theory, geologically, there are these little pockets. Because I was the only kid who did it. You know, you'd get a knife and you'd just go... And then you pull it back, and you dig out a bit of soil, and you hide something, and close it down, and you couldn't. Well, you'll be relieved to know that we've all got to the bottom of page card. Yes, I've explained to you that I will try and address the silly fact that I mistakenly gave my talk a title and a subject matter, and I have got some notes for that later on. But in the meantime, I will just read you a few things. I think that's yes. Oh, no, I know what I was trying to do. I was going to take this coat off. One of my choreographed moves was to take the coat off about 10 minutes ago, and I forgot it. It's been it's just sitting in the back of my head thinking, that was something I should have done. What was it? It's not a trivial matter, because I have things now to do with these properties. And it's all set up. It looks spontaneous, but don't believe it. But anyway, yes, 60. I've got some... I think this book is mostly full of my mother and father, really. And they adopted me, and they were hard-working in lots of ways. They were wonderful as well, of course. And an adopted child, if he's got any sense, recognises that, unless he's terribly unlucky, the worst family in the world is better than the best institution, because my mother and my father distinguished me, and they loved me, and they attended to me. And a home can't quite do that in the same way. This is my mum. This is a piece called The Boat. My mum came back from Birmingham, removed her hat and coat, kicked off her shoes and sighed and said, "I nearly bought you a boat." I knew this boat. I'd seen it in a shop on Colmore Row, a clockwork tin toy steamer plus box, Chad Valley and Co. I knew this boat. Its painted tin, its funnel with a key, its painted passengers, its flags. It was the boat for me. So all I heard was boat and bought. The clock in the kitchen stopped. I never heard the nearly until the penny dropped. Mum made herself a cup of tea and buttered me a scone and spoke of Auntie Elsie's legs and switched the wireless on. Some other boats I know I had, a paddle boat, a yacht, an Airfix model landing craft, all more or less forgot, like paper boats in the gutter, soon swirling down the drain. Only that steadfast nearly boat sails in my memory plain. The prettiest, shiniest, never gift, just destined to become the present most treasured from the past, from my old mum. Thanks, Mum. And that poem, you remember I mentioned earlier on, I spoke about a rhyme that I thought the rhyme lap and back, my mother had me on my lap on the train, and lap and back don't rhyme. And that I thought that would give some authenticity. In this case, it's the other way around in a way, because it wasn't a boat. My mother nearly bought me a mouth organ in a beautiful little box with a... And I couldn't get a poem out of a mouth organ. I don't know that I did the right thing, but the feeling's the same. It's just that. Here's my dad. My dad was a labourer, a rough man, but much more than a rough man. I mean, Ernest Bevin was probably a labourer and a rough man. My dad. My dad makes little soldiers in moulds with molten lead, with caps and guns and bayonets, and paints them green and red, and blue and black and silver. They line up in a row, with hair and eyes and eyebrows, each one of them just so. My dad works as a labourer. His hands are seamed with grime, and cracked and cut and calloused, and no amount of time spent scrubbing in the washhouse or soaking in the sink can shift that dirt away, though the water's black as ink. The bosses in Dad's factory don't notice him, I'll bet. No suit, no tie, no title, he's easy to forget. But back at home it's different. Who's bothered with a suit? For me, I love Dad's army. And the soldiers, they salute. He used to make things out of fretwork. I don't know how many of you are familiar. I can see a few heads like mine that suggest that you've heard of fretwork. It's like a sewing machine, a little treadle, and you had a very thin blade, and you could cut intricately the most delicate patterns in wood. and build things out of them. And there was a commercial organisation, I think, called Hobbies. And my dad made wonderful things out of wood and fretwork. And the idea that he was a rough labourer who, in his own time, was a skilled man is quite touching, I think. One more. So that's Mum and that's Dad, and here are the three of us together now in the kitchen. With the clothes horse. Clothes horse, again, for the younger members of the audience, is a wooden frame set up in the kitchen to dry clothing when the weather was bad outside. A wooden frame like a folded fence or a windbreak 3 feet high. It stands in the kitchen on winter nights with the washing spread out to dry. And into that steamy tent I creep. And under that 60-watt sun, I spy on the enemy's forces and pick them off with my gun. My hair slicked flat, my cheeks are pink, my face has an apple shine. The rest of the room is Mum and Dad's, but the clothes horse space is mine. And under those billowing sheets I sail, over those rag rug waves, to islands of parrots and pirates, palm trees and treasure caves. My dad sits painting a soldier. My mum sits darning a sock. The fire shuffles down in the fireplace. Time ticks by in the clock. And I sit tight in the clothes horse, where the socks and the palm trees sway, directing my soldiers and shipmates, hard at work at my play. The radio talks in the corner, just William, Itmar, news. Mum pours tea from the teapot. Dad cleans a pair of shoes. A wooden frame like a folded fence or a deck chair on its side, with laundered flags a-fluttering and room for a boy to hide. The air has a soapyish flavour, a freshly ironed smell, while our lives shuffle down in the kitchen. I remember the embers well. Oh, God, I'm sorry. Oh, I knew you were doing that. Someone would do that. Thank you very much. So that was me. That you can imagine this elderly man now remembering quite vividly, really, his life as a little child, 4 or 5 or 6, sitting in the clothes horse in this funny little kitchen. And I can pick out an awful lot of the details of it. And now, of course, I'm much older. And I've lately become a grandparent. My daughter Jessica and her partner Ian had their first baby in January, so I'm now the proud grandfather of a pretty well six-month-old, granddaughter. Yes. Be careful what you wish for. I was offered, and it was too late for me to realise what I could do, I was offered a PowerPoint presentation with projectors and everything else, and only after I'd said, no, I don't want any of that, I realised I could have entertained you for the next 3/4 of an hour with images of... It is, you know, many of us, I'm sure, are familiar with the absurdity that all grandchildren are beautiful and wonderful and talented. And I've scoffed at this, of course. And yet, miraculously, it turns out that my granddaughter... and the technology with which I am quite unfamiliar allows you to send... So they send me these tiny little videos, like a 2-minute video, which is a little picture of this little baby. And the baby's just sitting there, like, and then the baby will sort of go... And it's this tiny little movement. It's better than Quo Vadis or Ben Hur. I find myself instinctively. My daughter lives down in Brighton, and we live in Bath, so it's quite a long way. But we go down an awful lot, and we're thinking of moving, of course, and all that stuff. I find. When she was very, very little, when she was just a few weeks old, and we were walking around the town with Ian and Jessica and the baby would be crying, and I'd have control of the baby, and I'd be doing this, and I would be carrying the baby around, and I started whistling to her. I used to sing to Jessica when she was little, but singing now in public is not something I would do, although I'm going to do it later on. But whistling, I became the whistling grandfather, and that's why It'll only take half an hour. Oh, here it is, yes. You can't really see it, but there we are. See that's the whistling granddad. That's me. Now, if you've ever seen a child transfixed by music, the only small problem is that Ian, Jessica's lovely young partner, doesn't seem quite as musical as his daughter. And after a mere half an hour of my whistling, he starts to flinch. Yes, so I thought, well, yes, here's an opportunity for a lullaby. I did write a lullaby. I remember I wrote a little lullaby. I did a book of football poems some years ago, and I wrote a lullaby for a referee's baby, a lullaby for a referee. Attend carefully to the title, Referee's Baby, and listen, attend to the final line. It's the only reason why the piece ever got written. But it is a lullaby, and I shall sing it to you. I can't sing, but it can't be helped. The pitch is cold and dark. The night is dark and deep. The players all have gone to bed. So sleep, baby, sleep. The whistle's on the shelf. The boots are in a heap. The kit is in the laundry bag, so sleep, baby, sleep. The house is warm and dark, the stairs are dark and steep, and Daddy's here beside your cot to send you off to sleep. The notes that I've got here are mainly written in black and underlined in red, but and that normally happens a week or so before I'm due to arrive. And then, after a while, little nervous notes begin to appear in green. When a day or so before, I think, oh, is that a good thing to do? And I start crossing out the many. And then the final notes are in blue. So it becomes. Because things link up. And I thought, well, I'll read you this one. I'll sing you this one as well. Because I am getting close now to this business of trying to deal with the notion of children's books for adults. And this is obviously for little children in a sense, but I feel that... actually, I do have an absolutely rock-solid argument to support the idea of children's books for adults, which you'll hear in a moment. Anyway, this is plainly for tiny children, but perhaps there's a bit of meat there for us as well. Called Everybody Was a Baby Once. Again, it requires me to sing. Any really musical people can leave now. Everybody was a baby once. Everybody was a baby once. Everybody went to beddy with a little furry teddy. Everybody was a baby once. The baby comes first in life's great plan. Everyone started out small. The child is father to the man. The race begins at a crawl. Oh, your daddy was a baby once, and your mummy was a baby once. Yes, your daddy and your mummy used to sit and suck a dummy. Everybody was a baby once. Life begins with a baby's cry. Life begins in a cot. A little tear in a little eye. A little bum on a pot. Oh, your granddad was a baby once, and your granny was a baby once. Yes, your granny, please don't laugh, used to whittle in the bath. Everybody was a baby once. Everybody was a baby once. Everybody was a baby once. Everybody went to beddy with a little furry teddy. Everybody was a baby once. So, yes, I've got a couple more. And this, Charlotte, that's it. I did read to you that little piece by Len Clay earlier on, The Letter from the Guardian, which was about trying to deflate the sense of ego that can arise in a speaker sitting up on a platform. And this has also to do with something else, really, which is that There's one voice. I feel uncomfortable sometimes. It's monotonous because it's me all the time, you see. And so I have a couple of things to do about that in a moment. But this helps to dispose of my voice because this is a slightly different voice. It's called Talk Us Through It, Charlotte. Or as I should say, Talk Us Through It, Charlotte. Something happening to the sound there? Charlotte grew up in the Black Country. I appreciate that Ledbury is West Midlands, really, but my own patch is Dudley and West Bromwich, and most particularly Albury and Smithwick. And this is Charlotte. Charlotte participated in a football match. And when a footballer on TV scores, does well in a game, he comes on TV afterwards and they say, talk us through it, Brian. Talk us through it, Brian. Tell us how you scored this one. Talk us through it, Kevin. So this is Talk Us Through It, Charlotte. Talk us through it, Charlotte. Well, I shouldn't have been playing, really. Only there to watch me brother. My friend fancies his friend, you know. Anyway, there was a man short. Stay out on the wing, they said. Give him something to think about. So I did that for about an hour. Never passed to me or anything. The ball kind of rebounded to me. I thought, I'll have a little run with it. I mean, they wasn't passing to me, was they? So off I went. I ran past this first boy. He sort of fell over. It was a bit slippery on that grass, I will say that for him. Two more of them come at me. Only they sort of tackled each other. Colloided. I kept going. There was this great big fat boy. One way or another, I kicked it through his legs and run round him. I took a time. Me brother was shouting, pass it to me, like. Well, like I said, I'd been there an hour. They never give me a pass. Never even spoke to me or anything. So I kept going. Beat this other boy somehow. Then there was just the goalie. Out he came, spreading himself, as they say. I was really worried. I thought he was going to hug me. So I dipped my shoulder like they do. And the goalie moved one way, you know. And I slammed it in the net. Turned out afterwards it was the winner. The manager said I was very good. He wants me down at training on Tuesday. My friend says she's coming as well. Crikey. I'll skip that one. Okay, so on to card three. We're doing all right. Oh, yes, this is... It's customary to put questions and comments and so on from the audience at the end of these things. And I think it's far more fun to put it somewhere in the middle or before the end. So if you come up with a load of rubbish, dud, boring questions, then I can always... anyway, it allows me it gives it a shape. So if anybody would like to join in or comment or boo or leave or speak... Please, and don't, if you don't want to, don't. I'll just drink this coffee like you know. Oh, yeah, sorry, yes.
We're familiar with quite a lot of your books as a family. Some of your older books, where your first wife was illustrating. I'm interested to know how you chose your more recent illustrators, because you've written with quite a few different...
Yes, yes.
The styles are very different. Do you have a say over who you choose, or
yes,
or are you put together sort of?
No, I mostly write something and go to the publisher with it, and then we talk about illustrators. And I yes, I wouldn't want to do so. I wouldn't want to make it's all agreed before you do the book. So the publisher may say that here's a good illustrator, or I may say here's a good illustrator, or the illustrator could say I'm a good illustrator. And then you discuss it, and so yes, it's not. It is. I haven't made a book with anybody who's worked. I've made books with people who I subsequently feel I made a mistake. Not because they didn't have talent, but because in a couple of cases they weren't the people. You've got to go the extra mile, you know. They wouldn't go the extra mile, so the book could have been better if they'd sweated a bit more. But mostly, it's. it's mutual, and I haven't made a book with anybody whose work I didn't really like.
Can I ask you about Each Peach Pear Plum from a long time ago? My children loved it. Where did you get the... Did it just come, the rhyme? Or...
I stole most of it. I mean, it's do you know the Opie's, Iona and Peter Opie's Language and Law of School Children? I'm sure some of you do in this room. It's a book, they gather together the playground rhymes of English school children, most of them the 1940s.
Yeah, the Opie book, yeah.
And one of them was Each Peach Pear Plum, and it had, but it ended, it had Mickey Mouse in it, it had a whole string of characters, and he said, but it ended with something like, Betty Grable is a star, STAR. That was the ending, and so all I did was I took a fragment of this piece, and I must have noticed that you could hide things in the pictures, and that it would make a narrative. But that's where it came from. Also, interestingly, we'd done a book with Puffin, and that was it. I think it was the old joke book, and. They wanted us to do another book, and we wanted to do another book. And we did a book. I wrote a poem called A Pair of Sinners, which, again, many of you may not have heard of. And it was a long Victorian kind of ballad. And the publisher said they thought it was pretty good, but it wasn't a picture book. They said it wasn't a picture book. So then we did another little book called The Little Worm Book, which is a ridiculous tiny little book called The Little Worm Book, all about worms. And they said, this isn't a picture book. And so then there was Janet, and Janet was waiting for me to and I must have hit upon this Opie thing, and I wrote it in a day, and they said, this is nice, we'll do this one. So gradually, quite soon, we got control over our own work. It wasn't, the decisions were ours, not theirs, but at that point, their commitment to making a particular sort of book was helpful. So that's how it happened.
Thank you.
Yes.
From everything that you've written, do you have a favourite piece, something that you keep coming back to?
I guess yes. I'm sure I do, and it's a different answer every time. no, because because I write short things, there are quite a lot of them, and I write different kinds of things. So I like The Jolly Postman. I think The Jolly Postman is quite a neat idea. I like the idea of it and the fun of it. And of the longer texts I've written, well, not very long really, but I wrote a book called My Brother's Ghost, which I quite like. And I wrote a book of poems in stories in verse called The Mighty Slide, which I quite like. So there probably are half a dozen that I would pick out that are different kinds that I like, yes.
You made a distinction between verse and poetry. I think we all know what you mean by verse. I'm just wondering whether you could explain a bit more what you think.
Well,
I
would hesitate to do. I'll respond to what you've asked me, and I'll have a go. But I did give a little thought to this when I was coming here, and I realise that I have some quite primitive ideas about poetry, which aren't supported by reading or knowledge or study or whatever. I do like writing verse. I think that's what I do, mostly light verse. And there is a genre of light verse. It's usually formal, and it's not free, and it rhymes, it has structure. But above all, it's accessible. And I'm sure we can all think of... Everyone in this room likes poems, or they wouldn't be here. Well, why are you here if you like poems? It's another matter. But poems, it seems to me, giving it no thought or study, there's an element of mystery and layers and not knowing something. That you love the poem for what it doesn't... You can sense... There's a certain kind of vagueness in it. That won't do either. Anyway, what I do is often pretty well crystal clear. For good or ill, you don't have to fight your way through my meaning, if there is one. It's just there it is. That sounds like modesty. It isn't really. I mean, all writers are the same. A writer, if he's any good, he just gets up in the morning and he picks his pen up or presses the keyboard or whatever and makes what he can make. And some poets, Betjeman is a wonderful, Betjeman's a wonderful thing. Is Betjeman a poet? Yes, he's a poet, isn't he? But he's not Larkin, is he? And Larkin isn't Yeats, is he? I mean, the mystery of it is... The only question is it any good? And of course, the other good thing is it's desirable that we have this great variety. I mean, Billy Collins is writes completely charming things, doesn't he? And then they're completely wide open. They aren't. And then you read this poem and you think, God, I love this poem. I don't know what it means. I love it. And that's what I think I don't do. And I'm not really apologising. I'm just merely describing. Oh dear. Is that the time? I've got about 6 minutes. Well, okay. I think I'm inclined really to... I've got a whole section here which is... I was going to address this notion, this ridiculous thing of... And children's books, children's poems for adults. Well, I'll just skid through it because I'd much rather end by reading one or two things here. It takes a chain of adults to reach the child anyway, you see. The adult who writes it, he's a writer. If it's a picture book, illustrator, an adult, editor, an adult, designer, an adult, librarian, teacher, bookseller, parent, grandparent, auntie. And they're all adults. So if this thing did not have some material in it that interested the adult, how on earth would it ever clear all these hurdles to get to the child? And then the other nice idea, which is that... The most wonderful thing to write, I suppose, would be to write something which amused a baby, a 2 or 3 year old, and then later on, when this baby was 5 or 6, he would still find something in this thing that pleased it, and then on he goes right the way till, as a grandparent, reading it back to its little child, the grandparent can still find some pleasure in the piece, and that can be done as well. But in my case, I think all I just do is I just do what I do. I get up in the morning, and I get down to my shed, and I pick up my pen and I make some marks on the paper and try and come up with something that I like, and then it turns out that what I tend to make is for children. So it's for me and for my fellow 5-year-old. I think that's more or less it. And I'm going to wrap it up with. This is why I took my. Do you mind when I tell you I had to take my jacket off because I had to get to this pocket. I can't remember what's in here now, but there's something in here. Oh, gosh. I'm sorry, I never got around to telling you about this panda. This panda's sat there very patiently all this time. I did read you the piece about the mangle, didn't I? There's a very funny piece in the book, which is about me mangling a panda when I was a little child. Not this panda, not this panda, but this panda sat on my desk and fixed me with his savage little eye and said, "Did you mangle a panda?" But I haven't got time for that. And it's just reminding me that I am sorry about this. I mean, this is such a chaotic thing. But you can see why I'm sorry, really. This rabbit, without complaint, has been sitting in that bag for nearly an hour. He has no part to play in this story. He's a companion to the panda. He came with the panda. And his name is Roy, and he's wonderful. If you look at him carefully, you'll see that he's slightly nuts, really. He's got that kind of... Can you see the way his mouth goes? A very funny little sort of... And I feel very bad, because had you been an audience of children, I would not have done... I got so carried away with abstruse philosophic and poetical analysis that I forgot the I mean... I had a whole riff on soft toys. You know, these soft toys they're comic. When I walk, I'm very alert to little children these days, of course, for obvious reasons, and I hardly ever see a little child in the town where I live walking through the town without the little child unconsciously just doing this. It's got a toy. And what they are, they're repositories of love. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? The way they learn love is the way the love they feel and that's given and received by the living flesh and blood people they live with. But they practice it with these little things, and they suck them and love them, and I think it's brilliant. Oh Christ, I forgot all this as well. I'm sorry. I'm going to read. I must read a couple of these because they're so good. I've still got 3 minutes. You're supposed to. You have to wait for the joke. You can't. You mustn't laugh before the joke. I've never had quite. I mean, I knew. I often do miss time, but never to this extent. Obviously, you get distracted and waffle, don't you? Children's letters. I get lovely children's letters, and I always carry some with me just to read one or two to you. And I'll just read. I've just got perhaps three. This one came from America in 2005 from a boy named Morgan Blaine Schilling. Morgan Blaine Schilling. I shall read it in an American accent. Dear Mr. Allberg, hi. My name is Morgan Blaine Schilling. I'm in third grade. I'm not a good writer or a good reader. I'm glad you write easy books. I have blue eyes and brown hair. I have a dog named Honey. And a sister. This has some bearing on relevance to the whole poetic enterprise. I do like Ledbury. I've never been to Ledbury before. It's a genuine, perfect little place to have a poetry festival. This has some bearing on children and poetry. Dear Miss Allberg, I've been looking at your books for a long time. I hope you are writing another book. My favourite book is Herded in the Playground. I find your poems very funny. On Friday at school, we read poems out to the class. My teacher, Mrs. Dipnell, gives us lollies. Because the deeply ingrained in this little child's mind is that poetry and lollies go for you. This came from Colombia, Bogota. Dear Alan Allberg, thank you for the book that you sent us. I like the book. I really like the book. One of the best poems is Please, Mrs. Butler. Could you call me at my house? My telephone number is 321-7227. I really like your books. Do you have sons? I think if you had sons, they should like to write books. And the final one is the bookend of the lovely Len Clay letter that I began with, which made me put my feet on the ground and reminded me of my unimportance, as it were. Dear Mr. Allberg, I am writing to tell you how much I like your books and poems. My best book is Please, Mrs. Butler, and Slow Dog Falling on Fast Fox. And I like the bit in Please, Mrs. Butler when the girl keeps saying, Please, Mrs. Butler, this boy Derek Drew keeps copying my work. I wonder what your favourite author is. My favourite author is Dick King Smith. Well, 2 minutes over time, I'll read what was always going to be my ending, which is a little poem from the book of Black Country Memories of My Own Childhood. I just like it, really. And it's here somewhere. And it's called Street Lamps. I shall read this and then I shall stop and go home. And I have enjoyed it. It's a nice space, isn't it? And this is a human scale, it seems to me. I've got far, far better than O2, which I was offered. Street lamps. The street lamps of my childhood are gaslit, yellow and green, a series of safe havens with darkness in between. On winter nights when I come home from the chip shop or the park, the shadows lengthen between the lamps, and I feel the clutch of the dark. It's foggy, perhaps, rain in the air, an ebony pavement that gleams, privet hedges, garden gates, but nothing is what it seems. A limping man in the lamplight with a scar or a blackened eye, a smoker or cougher or spitter of phlegm, an uninnocent passerby. A cat in a hedge or something. A pair of eyes, at least. A foot-dragging sound in an entry. Some nameless lurking beast. While under each glowing umbrella, I shelter from the dark. With my hot chips from the chip shop, my cold feet from the park. There's a ruffian in the entry. a hunchback at my heel. I run for my life in stages, for fear that my fears are real. An iron tree, a crossbar, where the lighter's ladder leant. A glass box with a pointed top, like a small transparent tent. The terrors of life await us. They lurk in the shadows between the islands of hope and brightness, the pools of yellow and green. Thank you.